Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Human Rights Demand. My name is Mary Neal. I'm here to welcome you to the show that is called Dr. Ansari Human Rights Reports. Dr. Ansari is an international human rights attorney who has come here to Human Rights Demand to give us reports regarding our human rights, our international human rights. Dr. Ansari, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Mary.
Wonderful. I'll turn it over to you, sir.
This is. Thank you for your introduction. This is a continuation of our talk on political status, legal status, indigenous people. And this really concerns the Afro-descendant peoples that have been colonized and have been enslaved by the European nations and are now, at this stage in history, are a distinct indigenous people. In particular, these groups are African-American of Afro descent from Hawaii, from the United States, and from the islands surrounding the United States. These islands and these people are for the most part, are recognized indigenous people. Now, there are some people that have some steps towards indigenous self-determinating determination status, such as the Hawaiians and the Indians and the Gullah Geechee, and some Moors who have taken steps toward federal recognition that the African American descendants have not. And the reasons for that is because of the indoctrination that we all get as a result of being involved and in attendance in colonial education. In colonial education, the reasons why the white occupants, Caucasian occupants, European settlers, have preeminent rights. Well, that's not the case. They do not have preeminent rights to the land mass in the United States or in the territories of Hawaii or in the territories surrounding the islands toward the United States. Neither the British nor the French or any other colonial country have preeminent rights. Preeminent rights are indigenous rights. These are rights that can never be usurped by a colonial or an opposing force of foreign nationals. Indigenous people always, always, always have the right to self-determination that are preeminent. That's the highest level of a right to a landmass that can a land territory that a people can have. Now you have the variations in the rights of people to the land that they have based upon their understanding and their knowledge of those rights, because African Americans and Hawaiians and the Gullah Geechee and some of the Black Indians have given up some of their authority that they don't need to give up. For example, in Hawaii, I was just informed that the Hawaiians are in a U.S. court concerning their own land. Not the proper court and not the proper way to do that, because indigenous people have preeminent rights, which means they are a sovereignty, just like the U.S. is a sovereignty. So if there's a dispute between two sovereignties, then that dispute does not go to one of the sovereign's courts, because that court is obviously going to be biased. So that dispute would be in a unbiased form or in an unbiased court, which is usually one of the international courts or one of the international forums. Likewise with the black Indians who had given up their right, their sovereignty, by allowing the United States to make a decision in the Cobo case, which was a $56 billion case that gave the Indians the right to have compensation, reparation for land that the United States as a trustee had somehow given or neglected to protect, and the land was eventually sold to white settlers. As a compensation, the Indians received $56 billion, and the African Americans appealed because the white Indians, that is a correct definition or description of the American Indian as close as I can give you. The reason why is because in the early 1800s, the United States passed a one-drop law in order to disavow or dismiss or disallow Africans who have of indigenous roots and of indigenous mixtures the right to hold and obtain land. So they passed this one-drop rule that allows, that has now had the effect of that most people that we call Indians in the United States are less than 20% of the total Indian population, which is about 2.1 million. About 1.8 million or more are not really what we call Indians, because they have an admixture that was artificially given to them by the apartheid laws of the United States. This means that the African American and the other indigenous people have a higher degree of accrued interest, indigenous interest in the land, than the people that are commonly referred to as Indians or indigenous people. The African American Indians gave up some of their sovereignty because of the fact that the case went in the first instance to a U.S. court, and they compensated. They have not, as of this point, have been able to take their case and their interest to a unbiased forum for a determination as to what their reparative interests would be. And Africans of indigenous descent cannot allow that to occur. Now, in the United States, with the Afro-descendants, Afro-Americans in the United States, the civil rights organizations have just banded together, the NAACP and the Urban League, and about 60 of their cohorts. I say cohorts because they have assumed that they have the authority, which we did not give them, to represent us as our leaders, which we did not elect them. And they have given President Obama an agenda of goals that are confused. And these goals are not really goals for African-American people. They're goals for the nation. They are a democratic, from the Democratic Party agenda. This is a really co-opted approach that we've seen before from the NAACP and Al Sharpton now and the Urban League, Marcus Moriel, of giving away or giving up our right to self-determination and looking forward to American authority to somehow compensate us, which they have never did and have never even rightfully considered because of the parochial way that we approach the issue of compensation, repatriation, restoration and restitution. They've given the United States as our agenda, number one, to achieve economic parity for African Americans. Now, they say that's a goal. No, that's not a goal, right? That is a right. We have an absolute labor interest that has not been compensated. We also have harms that have not been compensated that are economic as a result of economic and market exclusions pursuant to apartheid law. The second part of their agenda is promote equity and educational opportunity. That's not a goal. That is a right. That's a human right under the Covenant on Economic and Social and Cultural Rights. Protect and defend voting rights. That is redundant because if you're a citizen, that means that you don't have to defend your voting rights. So that is not only inapplicable, but it is also a right. It's not a goal. It's a right under the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, as well as a constitutional right, or supposed to be a constitutional right. And this is the play between the Constitution and the American Civil Rights Negro leader, so-called leader, who seems to have no understanding that this is a constitutional as well as an international right, not a goal. To promote a healthier nation, which is also a right, and to achieve comprehensive criminal justice system reform. Well, in the last 20 years, there's been hundreds of conferences between political scientists and who discuss how to reform criminal justice system, and it cannot be reformed because it is a system by occupiers. It is a system by foreign occupation of those who have usurped illegal authority over the African American people. So there can be no reform of that, except for a disjointment of the African American from the American criminal justice system diagram. This is a real basic understanding that most criminal justice people understand, because you have white judges, you have white public defenders, you have a Caucasian district attorneys, and you have, for the most part, in cases you have a Caucasian dominated jury. This is biased. This is illegal court proceeding, because court proceedings are supposed to be fair and unbiased. So the way that the United States has been indoctrinated is a way that punishes excessively African Americans, that gives them excessive sentences, as well as brutalizes them and by the police factors, and that this behavior is condoned to the extent that it has become a part of the customs of the United States. So when you have a custom, and the civil rights proponents know this, when you have a custom, it is very difficult to unsettle that custom by even legislation, and this is the reason why the Civil Rights Act has failed to bring about change, and why 60 years after the Civil Rights Acts have passed, they're still talking about voting rights, educational opportunity, economic parity, and a comprehensive criminal justice system reform. It's the reason why is because of the entrenched customs, racial customs in the United States have been unable to overcome the disparity, and the legislation has not helped. So what is the alternative? The alternative for indigenous people is self-determination. Make your own determinations as to criminal justice, courts, land, and so on and so forth. And the reason why that is well-founded international law is because of the common sense notion that no one has the ability to lord over you unless you give them that consent and that ability. And this is one of the some of the lessons that we will be studying pursuant to the international courses that we are presenting regarding the training of human rights monitors who will monitor these various issues, and our human rights defenders who will file in unbiased court forms. And this is a way that we can, as an independent, self-determining people, be able to protect our generations and our families, and so that they can have a higher quality of life than we have had to endure. So this is this issue between the civil rights approach and the human rights approach has to be reconciled through discussions, conversations, and votes between those people who are civil rights proponents and those people who are indigenous rights and self-determination. And this has to be meted out. It cannot be just given to the civil rights people as they have some type of authority over the rest of us, and it's illegal. So what we're doing is presenting an objection to these civil rights organizations having any type of authority to make such presentations because they have not consulted with the rest of us, and they have to consult with the rest of us, and we have to, and the Pan-Africanists, the nationalists, the indigenous people, in order to have a broad-based representation of the African-American people. And this type of broad-based consent is called democracy. This has to be a democratic approach. And the approaches of the various tribes are also should be run by democratic approaches. And we've had some glitches in that because some of the tribes, because of the way that they reach back to older times, have a situation of chiefs and kings and queens, which is a very archaic way to govern. In fact, it's the most archaic way to govern, and it gives rise, and we should be well aware of that. Every time I see a group of people, a tribe or a fledgling nation or a group of people collected that want to be recognized, and I see that they're organized with a queen or a king or some type of monarchy, It's a problem because these kings and queens and monarchies are easily able to be corrupted, or they are probably laboring under archaic legal concepts that will not push their agenda. and that's a problem. It's a problem in good governance. But as an outsider to some of the nations and who have and groups and tribes that have this type of organization, that is just a foreboding sign to me that the tribe or organization can be easily corrupted by just corrupting the king, queen, or the monarch. But these are some growing pains that because of the disruption of our lineal lines and the disruption that gave us the sense of governance, and because of our lack of understanding of being independent, truly independent, which is a constant fight for all of us. And I don't want to in any kind of way to say that the same problems that affect the civil rights people and their thinking do not affect the rest of them. Being under the constant authority of foreign occupation does that. It debilitates the mind from being independent. And it's a constant struggle. So it's something, it's a phenomenon that we have to really pay attention to. I've had some people, intelligent people, the NAACP and the Urban League are intelligent people. Some of them are professors. I see in the signing of this agenda about 30 to 40 people who have a doctorate degree in front of their name. But just because they have a doctorate degree for their name, it does not mean that they are intelligent. It means that they're smart. It means that they have the ability to take tests, but it doesn't mean that they have a fully functional brain, because part of their brain has been debilitated. And this happens. This happens. It's a constant struggle to think after being under the auspices of this type of structure to be an independent thinker. But when we independently think of what has been done to us and what we must do to get out of this situation, then we have to use our rational mind. We have to have rational thinking. So now we have in this two parties who believe they're both rational. The civil rights people and those people with those types of thinking, they think, oh, this is just a pipe dream, or this couldn't possibly happen, or you must be a radical, or you must be some type of bad person who is not correct. And on the other hand, we who are independent in our thinking are thinking, well, this must be someone who's obviously kind of smart, but has a debilitated sense. I think Malcolm said it better, or described it better than anyone when he made the distinction between house Negroes and field Negroes. When the plantation caught fire, the house Negro would be the first one out there, throwing water on the plantation house to save his house and run in the house and save his master and to do everything he could to save the plantation. Well, the field Negro was hoping that it would burn down as soon as possible. This is the two types of thinking. It's between the in-house thinking and the out-house thinking. Now, another question is, which is the most rational thinking in this type of issue? Is it to save or to be loyal to or to be patriotic to a people who have not shown us loyalty, patriotism, or kindness. Should that type of thinking be rewarded by identifying with that type of situation in a way that we want to be a part of it and we want to save the burning house? Or is it the more correct thinking to understand who we are, what has been done to us, and what our proper response would be to save ourselves and our children from further mistreatment? And when we step back and look at it, we see that the Caucasian or the Anglo does not have this problem in identification with and his concept of white nationalism, which is what's being practiced on us, white nationalism, what is best for the white nation, what is best for the white corporation, at the behest of people of color, not only in the United States, but all around the world. When you look at the dynamics of who is the aggressor, who is the party that is moving to exploit other people, then at that point your rational mind should kick in. But this is a process of maturity, process of information, a process of knowledge that we have to come to. It really bothers me when we send our children off to fight wars for them, to get killed, to take bullets for people that do not love us, that tries to exclude us from a quality of life based upon our color, based upon our historical travels. This is the insanity that we have come to, where we have people with doctor's degrees in front of their names. When they try, they say that this is a meeting, a historic and unprecedented meeting, a first step in developing a public policy agenda toward the primary challenges facing African Americans, urban communities, and all low and unworking class Americans. Number one, they say that this is a plan for the nation. For whose nation? For the white nation? If they wanted the plan, they would have enacted legislation. It's obvious to those who are rational in their observations that this country is made up and in this way for a particular reason. Why it's obvious to those with rational observations to understand why there's disparity in education and income and why we have a problem with the police force, with the criminal justice system. And it's obvious from a impartial observer as to the insanity of these type of people being the ones who want to be the most loyal, who want to go to war to protect the burning house, to protect the master's house. This is the problem that most of us, because of our indoctrination, have to critically look at when we look at the definitions of indigenous status, of self-determination, the right to self-determination. When we look at those analyses, we have to look at them with an impartial intellect, an academic analysis of the elements of self-determination and who has those rights, which in essence is that every human being has those rights. We have to look at those, at the circumstances in our historical situation out of the eyes of a people who are trying to change it, who are trying to really change it and not do the same hat-in-hand things that are irrational, like going to a president who is one whose presidential administration has been the most the worst violator of human rights on the planet. We are looking at an administration who is hand in hand with a Zionist relationship with Israel that is second to none as far as the worst human rights offenders. The Americans against an invasion of other people's countries, major violation. They're oppressing the island, unprecedented. A group of people that say that they are leaders who go hand in hand to an administration who walked out of the international talks in Geneva when the talks was concerned about repairing our people for the harm that was done from slavery. The administration walked out at the behest of Israel and the European nations. They walked out. And the black president from the United States was the one who led the walk-off. So for a people who say that they are intelligent, doctors in front of their name, Ben Jealous, Al Sharpton, Mark Morial, lawyers. Mark Morial is a lawyer. I know him. We were at Harvard together 25 years ago when we were students. Intelligent, but debilitated in that part of their analysis. They cannot break away from that observation. So the question of status, legal status, indigenous rights, and self-determination is a learning status that we will train. As one of the things, one of the issues, one of the areas of study would be the right to self-determination, which is endemic in every international law. And it makes sense because the human being, if this is human rights law, that means that the human being is at the center of that. And a human being has certain inalienable rights. Am I right? They have certain, even the Declaration and the people that are oppressing us know this. So for us not to know that we have the inalienable right to self-determination means that we have been damaged in part of our brain, in part, some part of our brain cells have not been able to get our mind around that we have the right to make these determinations. So this is the posture, a position that many of us are in. A lot of us, and I have to commend most of us, especially those who are listening, those who will listen, that they have fought this type of disease that debilitates the mind. And many of us, and this is the reason why this agenda is so inappropriate, should have been included. Our views on independence and self-determination and our right to be our own collective should be addressed, because we despite the oppression, despite the bad harms that come to us, we still have the significant numbers. In fact, it looks like, from the polls that we've taken, that we are more significant and numerous than the few people who call themselves our leaders, such as Ben Jealous and Al Sharpton and Mark Morial from the Urban League, and the NAACP and the National Action Network, who say that they are our leaders. So this is the situation, and on political status that we will continue with in part three of this presentation on indigenous status, political identity, and where should we go from here?
Well, thank you, Dr. Ansari. Thank you. We have a caller who might have a question. Caller, do you have a question or comment?
Yes.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes.
Good morning, Dr. Ansari. Assalamu alaikum, aloha kakahiaka, from the Kingdom of Hawaii. This is your friend Poena from last week.
Hey, Poena. How you do? Very good.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm glad I was able to catch you. I do have actually a few supplemental points for your listeners, if you like. I actually stopped keeping track after a while because it became so numerous, you know, because a number of the points you brought up today, as a matter of fact, in my education of the public are a number of points that I've raised myself, as a matter of fact. So if you'll permit me a few minutes, I'd like to actually go through them real quick.
No, yes, go ahead.
Okay. First off, from when you started, I did want to point out that pertaining to the Kingdom of Hawaii and the situation we have here, the American presence is actually an act of imperialism rather than colonialism, because we were a nation that was recognized not just by the British and the French, but the Americans themselves. So the colonialism came after they acquired the land,
right,
and of it, socially. It was more of a social colonialism. Now, I'm glad you also brought
right.
up the point of federal recognition, because actually something that's been recommended to us from a number of our Indian, you know, Native American brothers is that not to accept federal recognition, because it would actually relinquish that inherent sovereignty that they acknowledge that we still retain in U.S. Public Law 103-150.
I don't know about that. I don't know quite about that, because it doesn't – and I'm not saying that they're incorrect. But federal recognition is just the federal government recognizing that you are sovereign. It may be talking about coming under the auspices of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which is
correct.
That may be a fear.
My understanding is that actually came from the Alaska Natives as a result of their settlement. In any case, there were that's. Just a matter of course. In any case, I was actually really glad to hear what you brought up about Al Sharpton and the example of the Urban League and NAACP, because we have our own version of it, which is actually an entity that belongs to the state of Hawaii, and it's known as the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. That's where all the quote-unquote Uncle Toms go to work, shall we say, because I really don't want to say the N-word,
right.
You know what I mean? But in any case, you know, just the whole fact of institutionalized discrimination actually under the color of non-discrimination. That's something. What I'd like to give an example of is the crab in a bucket syndrome, where Hawaiians are called, you know, we all, they're like crabs in a bucket. They're going to climb on top of each other and pull each other down before one gets to the top, because they're all trying to get to
right.
the top. Now, what I realize is that when half of the crabs are part of the bucket, you know, it's going to be considerably more difficult. In fact, I've actually
mm-hmm.
witnessed a circuit court judge refused judicial notice of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Now, I am aware that I believe it's more of a non-binding resolution, but regardless, you know, just the act in of itself, it demonstrates something. Now,
it's not non-binding. Often the United States says with certain declarations is that they've made reservations.
Mm-hmm.
They made delegations to the jurisdiction or certain parts of a declaration. Illegal or ineffective or inadequate. It just means that now you have to, since that's the United States position, that's that judge's position, that means that now you take that position of the United States and you take it before a international forum, which says
mm-hmm.
that, yes, you do have to recognize the indigenous rights of people. And then
mm-hmm.
that's of a different form. But, yeah, I understand.
Actually, the interesting part of that is just within the last couple of years of the state of Hawaii themselves actually passed a recognition of the fact that Obama had signed the UN DRIP.
That's right.
So, you know what I mean, and I witnessed that myself, and I'm curious to see whether that's going to show up in the transcripts, but, you know, I did witness that. Now, there was just other things, you know, before I you know, relinquish the time I'm taking from the rest of your callers. But I did really want to commend you on the bringing up monarchism and the problems that it does create, especially dynastism, you know, which is, you know, why I endorse a democratic process. But, you know, particularly what you're saying about, young black folk, you know, young Latinos, you know, Hawaiians, anybody who are sent to war against people that we have more in common with than the people who are giving the orders. An interesting point about that is that when it comes to the Hawaii situation, we are actually being coerced into involuntary violation of our status as a neutral nation because our children are being tricked into going to war.
That's right.
Yeah, now my final point, though, before I conclude.
It's the same thing that our children here in the U.S. are likewise tricked into into going into war.
Now, the last thing is, this is more of a point of interest that I want to bring up to you before I conclude, is that, interestingly enough, so we know that Obama is from Hawaii. Now, the high school that he went to, Punahou, is, well, aside from being the actual, my alma mater's rival, direct main rival, it previously was known as Oahu College. Now, this is where people like Lauren Thurston and Sanford B. Dole, by the way, I have something about from your last show, anyway, but this is where they went to school. Now, these are like your Ivy League. I mean, Punahou was basically the Ivy League high school of Hawaii. You know, that's how he had been Harvard. Now, it's interesting because Dole, Thurston, these men are directly responsible for the coup d'etat that resulted in the overthrow of the Kingdom of Hawaii. Now, it wasn't actually the Dole Corporation. It was actually Sanford Ballard Dole was the cousin of the founder of the Dole Corporation, and he's the one who paved the way for Dole to come here because he became the president of the Republic of Hawaii, and which was the provisional government when the overthrow first happened.
Mm-hmm.
So, that was all. I mean, that's just an interesting thing. You know, I wanted to. Thank you so much for the time. I do really appreciate what you're doing and what you're going to be doing.
Yeah, you know, I'm intending to I'm trying to put together a schedule to actually come to Hawaii, and I'll be in touch with you guys prior to that, because I do want to talk about the parameters of political status and what the possibilities are for your nation and where it should go from this point on. I'm looking forward to meeting you and the rest of the fellows there.
Absolutely. By the way, give my regards to Professor Boyle. By the way.
Yes, he's one of our best. He is our best international attorney.
Yeah, actually, come to find out that he actually knows us quite a number of us quite well already, which is promising. You know, I'm really encouraged by that. But. Thank you very much. I do appreciate it. Assalamu alaikum, my brother.
You too. Wa alaikum salam.
How are you?
Mary?
Well, hello, Dr. Ansari. What a wonderful lesson regarding indigenous people of whom African Americans belong in that group. And I am so glad that you came to bring this lesson today. We're out of time. And I invite everybody to tune in next Tuesday to Dr. Ansari's Human